Meditation starts now.
Serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
This one's called Solutions. Don't be afraid to explore. Without exploration, there are no discoveries. Don't be afraid of partial solutions. Without the tentative, there is no accomplishment. Indecision and procrastination are corrosive habits. Those who wait for every little thing to be perfect before they embark on a project, or who dislike the compromise of partial solutions, are among the least happy. Ideal circumstances are seldom given to anyone for an undertaking. Instead, there is uncertainty in every situation. The wise are those who can wrest great advantage from circumstances opaque to everyone else. Wanting everything in life to be perfect before you take action is like wanting to reach a destination without travel. For those who follow spirit, travel is every bit as important as the destination. One step after another, that is still central to the wisdom of spirit. Every day passes whether you participate or not. If you are not careful, years will go by and you will only have regrets. If you cannot solve a problem all at once, at least make a stab at it. Reduce your problems into smaller, more manageable packages, and you can make measurable progress towards achievement. If you wait for everything to be perfect in accordance with your own preconceived plans, then you may well wait forever. If you go out and work with the current of life, you may find that success comes from building upon small things.
All right. I'd like to read something out of our big book, see where this goes. Page 12. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation, a basis of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend Ebby. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I felt I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. So those two paragraphs, in my opinion, they sum up everything Brandon and I have been talking about since last night. This idea of willingness is completely born of our relationship with the first step. My first step experience will dictate my experience in every step thereafter. And as I go into a second step and a third step, I go deeper into my first step. Every step has a surrender inherent within it. Every step has a degree of becoming aware of the powerlessness that's tied to it. Tied into this idea of self-will versus God's will. Tied into this idea of how I can't just change my mind at times and just become willing to believe. Like sometimes it is a gift in of itself that I change my perspective. The powerlessness, how I've been unable to disclose my life to another human being for so long. My first fifth step was the first time I'd ever been honest with another human being and told them my entire life story in the form of resentments, fears, and my conduct in relationships. There's powerlessness associated with every step. And Bill here is talking about this foundation, you know, basis. Later on in the book, it says we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. And one of the definitions for the word basis is foundation. And now they're saying upon a foundation, and I'm saying upon a basis of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. And I believe the willingness is a gift. Otherwise, everybody would go through a horrendous set of circumstances and they would just become willing because it's rational and it makes sense. You've been through hell. It would make sense that you don't want to go back and you're going to take on a new course of action. But that's not what I've seen over my time here. And then he says, at long last, I felt, I believe, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me, and for a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. I remember going on a snowboarding trip when I was in treatment. We went up to Snowshoe, West Virginia, and we drove all night. So when we got up to Snowshoe, it was like 4 a.m. or something. The sun was not even close to coming up. I remember looking up, and it was the closest I remember not being under the influence of some substance and being that close to the stars. And I was overwhelmed with this sense of awe and like there is a sphere of influence behind all of this that's creative in nature. Like something is holding all this together. And I remember we went and checked into our condo and it was one of those high school shootings took place. And then you're flipped. The pendulum flips to the other side. And you're like, wow, man, what kind of God allows that kind of stuff to go on? And so you begin this ambivalent stance towards the idea of God, and you're so confused about, oh, is it really love? You know, I can report to you today, after all this time of investigating the spiritual realm, I don't think this idea of God thinks in the way a human mind thinks of good and bad. I think whatever God is infinite. It's multiplicity. It's a paradox. It's really the multiplicity of unicity. There is one entity, and we see faces of it all the time, and we see the multiplicity, and that's, for me, like God is not just a creator. Whatever God is a destroyer at the same time, and it allows me to make sense of the world. That's just something I work with. The real significance of my experience on Snowshoe Mountain burst upon me, and for a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly noises, clamors, mostly within myself. And so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. But see, that trip to Snowshoe was in this last 15 years. It wasn't one of those trips to treatment before. Yeah, I was confused after that trip because, you know, I'd seen both ends of the pendulum. I'd seen two faces of the universe, and one was beautiful and one was horrific. So at treatment, I was separated from crack cocaine and alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of DTs. Now, I was psychotic when I got here. I was hearing voices. You know, it's interesting. When I first started smoking crack, it would take about 4 or 5 days of staying up before I started to see the green men and like the shadow people and the voices, right? But near the end, I would smoke for 2 or 3 hours and I started hearing voices. And so I was having a psychosis very quickly. But see, something happened to me while I was in treatment. I did this third step in the closet. You know, the guy who was, this guy Randy was taking me through the book, and then I was going to my grand sponsor's house every Monday night, and I spent every Friday night with my grand sponsor. And Randy would come to the treatment center, and the first time he came to the treatment center, we went through the title page, the blank page, and we read the preface and the forewords. And then he asked me to read the doctor's opinion. He came back the next week, and we read the doctor's opinion. Then he asked me to read Bill's story. He came back the next week, we did Bill's story. And then there is a solution more about alcoholism. We agnostics. And then we get to the third step, and he's at the treatment center, and we were looking for a place to do the third step, and we literally went into a closet, a little storage closet, in the basement of this treatment center. And I got down on my knees with another man. I held his hands, and I read the third step prayer out of the big book, and he said, "Are you ready to work the rest of the steps?" Yes, and then I started writing inventory. That's how the process worked. There wasn't a big boom in the closet, you know. I didn't sense this overwhelming presence of God. I'd had enough booms in my life up to that point. I didn't need any more, you know. What happened to me was I sincerely took a position. I sincerely took a position. Now on page 63, at the top of page 63, the big book says, when we sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things will happen. Those remarkable things are different for each individual, but that has been my experience. And as I humbly offered myself to God in that closet, as I then understood him to do with me as he would, my life was no longer my business, but my conduct in my life was my business. The circumstances, the people in it, you know, the outcomes, no longer my business. But my character and my conduct had to be something I was willing to look at. Now, that would hit me later on, about 2 years later, because I began to hit bottom with the second half of the first step, which is internal unmanageability. But character has a lot to do with the spiritual path, and hopefully I'll come back again to that topic. I admitted, I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. You know, for me, what I did is I placed myself unreservedly under the care and direction of my sponsor and my grand sponsor at the time. I followed the dictates of a sponsor in the beginning. That was my experience. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. This is Bill. And the same experience happened to me. I ruthlessly faced my sins. When I wrote that first inventory, it was the first time I'd ever put pen to paper about all the people I was angry at. But a lot of that stuff, when I got to the fourth column, was all the things I had done that I just wanted to forget that I did all these people. And when he says here in our big book, my newfound friend with a capital F came to take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since. You know, there is a sense of buying in to what Randy and Dante were trying to communicate with me, that if I could disclose all the secrets and all the dark crannies, that somehow this spiritual entity called the 12 steps, like I really consider the 12 steps in themselves are a spiritual entity. They're a body. They all are connected. They're not linear. They're circular. But I bought into the idea that they were going to keep me safe and protected. And by extension, because I considered them to be a spiritual entity, they were really an extension of this power that I believed was in the universe. You know, this is how I experienced it early on. Now, everything would transition for me and evolve, because if you stay committed to the spiritual way of life, you're going to hopefully read a lot of books. You know, spirituality has been around way before Alcoholics Anonymous. All right, since ancient times, since they started writing shit down, we've had the spiritual realm. We've had spiritual teachers. And I've investigated, and I have now my own working ideas of how I move and navigate through life using these ideas. But what I bought into was my newfound friend for me, with a capital F, was the 12-step way of life. And by default, what's behind that was but the power of God. What first seemed a flimsy reed turned out to be the powerful and loving hand of God. Right. The flimsy reed for me was the 12 steps in the 3 years I bounced in and out. I'm not a one-chip wonder. I mean, I just went to my first 12-step meeting in September, I believe, of 2004. And my clean date's November 5th, 2007. All right, so over 3 years of bouncing in and out. And I picked up chips when I'd gotten high, you know, because I cared about, like, making progress, because I knew if I had some clean time, these girls would talk to me. I couldn't be, like, admitting I just, you know, smoked crack the other night. You know, that was the insanity of the delusion that I was experiencing at the time about what recovery was. So my sponsor visited me during the fifth step, and he fully acquainted me with his problems and his deficiencies. So one of the reasons I bought in was as I disclosed everything to my sponsor, he began to disclose his experiences to me. And as a result, I was more comfortable making a list of the people who I had hurt and to whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals and admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my thinking by my new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. And what I want to emphasize is test. I test this relationship with God. I ask for guidance and directions regarding spiritual matters. There are times when I go into meditation, and what I do is I have a decision I'm going to make. It's the last thing I'm emptying out before I sit for the meditation. And then I observe and witness what's stirring around in my consciousness as it relates to this decision I'm trying to make. And I see what comes. And sometimes an answer comes and I make a decision based on that. Sometimes nothing comes. And, you know, one of the things I was taught by a guy that was very close to me was, when nothing comes, don't do nothing. Don't do anything. Sit. It'll come. The funny thing is, I do believe every prayer. Currently, I believe that every prayer is answered. The thing is, I may say a prayer 3 months ago, and the answer shows up 3 months later. And these are things now that sort of make sense to me, because the human ego, and my ego in specific, you know, I was talking to a gentleman in between here. We live in this age where if you want to know something, I know you guys don't have your phones right now, but if Brandon and I want to know something, we just punch it into our phones, and all of a sudden we got the knowledge. We got the information. All right? And that's a hindrance when it comes to the spiritual way of life, because that's not the way the spiritual realm works. There is no linear timetable to all of this. My friend promised, when these things were done, you know, the 12 steps, these are the things, you know, common sense would thus become uncommon sense, right? Things that it did not make any intellectual sense now make sense to me and Brandon. You know, it's wild how you will, like, begin to look at things from a different perspective. Like, you will go through a painful experience full of sorrow, right? What used to, common sense would say that my experience with my father, of where I restored my relationship with my dad, and I want to talk about it later when I get to the amends process. When that relationship was restored and he was dying, having to be the primary caretaker, some people would say that's going to be an experience that's going to be painful, and it could have a negative impact on your spiritual condition. And it could be too time-consuming, and you have to put up boundaries. And not, I'm here to tell you, one of the most powerful spiritual experiences I've ever had was that 3 weeks I was taking care of my father. Watching him transition, being there for him, taking care of him, putting him in diapers, you know, washing him with a warm cloth, you know, sitting by his side and praying. And creating a space and playing music so he had a peaceful transition. Common sense for me would say, no, that's not going to be, that's just going to be a difficult human experience to go through. Not the way I experienced it. But it's only my commitment to the spiritual realm that allowed me to have that perspective while I was moving through the experience, along with the guidance of someone who had much more experience than me. My friend emphasized and promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. And you know, relationships, they have communication. We are beginning our cultivation of this relationship in the third step. In the third step, we're making a decision, right? That hereafter in this drama of life, that I'm no longer going to be the center of the universe or the director. That I am in this world to play the role that God assigns. And it could be a shitty role at times. And it has proven to be in my experience. And sometimes it's a good role. I think true humility is really, you know, this idea of having a desire to seek and do the will of God as often as possible. When I'm awake and aware to it. And whatever, I do believe everything I experience is the will of God. And my awareness and my expression of that knowledge is my expression of God being in my life. And so as I move through this process, that becomes like the central point of everything I'm doing in the relationship. Everything I experience, good or bad, gets related back to God. And being there are times, guys, when I've been so frustrated with what the circumstances of my life look like. And since I do believe God is everything and God brings me all the experiences, you know what I wanted to do to God? Fuck you, man. That's what I said. I told him to suck you. That's, I did. I'll never forget. I'll tell the story now. So like in 2014, December of 2013, I was going through the steps with a guy named Bob O from Denver, Colorado. And we were talking about God's will. And he said, Tarek, what are you willing to put on the altar? And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? He goes, well, let me ask you a question. When you think of this thing called God's will, what comes to mind? And I started saying all these colorful words like freedom and love and light. And he said, okay. He goes, look, because at the time I was married, he goes, you got a daughter, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, if your daughter was diagnosed with cancer and she died, is that God's will? If you lose your job tomorrow and you can't provide for your family, is that God's will? If your parents get in a horrific car accident and die tomorrow, is that God's will? He's like, Tarek, you can't look at God's will as just the positive. Everything is part of this thing called God's will. And I had 1 week to sit with that consideration. And so when he asked me to put everything on the altar, that means everything that I experience in life is my sacrifice to God, my offering. I'm okay with it. And it was a difficult consideration to sit with. So I made the decision and I began to write some inventory. And shortly thereafter, the following events unfolded in my life over a 9 month period, 9-10 month period. 5 surgeries, pain medication every time. My stepdaughter started having seizures and we found out she had epilepsy. We had to deal with her. We were in the hospital for a few days, and that was a scary experience. Then I experienced depression for the first time. Never experienced depression, man. The drugs and alcohol worked magic all those years. But I'm in sobriety, and I can't get out of bed. The windows, the blinds are closed. I'm not even binge-watching Netflix or Amazon or anything. I just cannot get out of the bed to the point where my wife has to go behind my back and call my sponsor so he gets involved. I had to put our dog down while my former wife was out of town on a girls' weekend, and the dog, I had to put it down, so she had to come home to no dog. Right? That was a difficult experience. Our house was broken into. At 7 years sober, my ex-wife and my stepdaughter and I have to move into my parents' house. You want to talk about, you know, an experience you don't want when you've been sober 7 years and you've been trying to get your life rebuilt and you've done so, and then boom, they don't feel safe in the house anymore. And so now we're back in my parents' basement. And I can't remember, am I leaving an event? Identity theft. Oh, I had to deal with identity theft. So somebody rang up tons of money in Estonia, Europe, some Eastern Bloc Europe country. And so I had to deal with getting all that resolved. All of these things transpired in 2014.
Don't forget about Hulkamania.
And then this one, I had knee surgery And in the knee surgery, they're telling me, hey, man, you're going to be on crutches for 2 or 3. It's arthroscopic knee surgery, no big deal. So I come out of surgery, and my doctor's looking at me with that look like we were wrong. And you got no cartilage in your right knee. You're going to be on crutches for 8 weeks. And we drilled some holes so the blood would coagulate and form some scar tissue for you because you're too young for a knee replacement. And so as a result, that was like actually when I started to go into the depression, I gained a lot of weight, right? And I went one day to put on one of my favorite shirts, and I was so frustrated with everything going on in my life that the shirt did not fit. And so I'm sitting there in the bathroom in the mirror, and I just fucking ripped this shirt off like Hulk Hogan. And I'm yelling in the mirror. You know, I'm swearing at God, and I'm telling him to F himself, and I can't believe this is what's going on after all the effing work I've done for you, blah, blah, blah. And I walk out of the bathroom, and I fall to my knees in the bedroom, and I said one of those meaningful prayers, which was, God help me, crying, God help me. Very impactful spiritual experience for me, one of the deepest that I've had. What was that based around? It was based around this idea that everything I experience is within the realm of God's will. And this idea that we're going to struggle and like, what's God's will and what's self-will? I have no idea. I do know that 15 years ago when someone looked at Tarek's life, they would have said, they would have used these descriptions. Tarek is self-will run riot. Tarek is living by self-propulsion. What does that mean? Tarek does what he wants to do when he wants to do it, and he doesn't give a shit how it's going to affect anybody else. Tarek is the producer of confusion rather than harmony. Tarek runs out and tells you he doesn't like drama, but there's nothing but drama around me, and I'm the center of drama, right? I talk behind people's backs. I try to win people to come over to my side. I tell one parent one thing so another parent will do something else. That's Tarek, the producer of confusion rather than harmony. And the funny thing is, I'm really a self-seeker, even when I'm trying to be kind to you, because I am taking stock, right? I am an accountant up here. So when I do something for you, you best believe you better repay that damn favor in the future. Even though in the moment, I want you to think that, dude, I'm just doing this for you because I'm a fun-loving hippie, man, and I like to do shit for everybody, right? I don't want anything back. That's the guy Tarek was. I thought I could violently twist and pull out of life the happiness that I wanted if I only controlled everything. Right? That's the guy that Tarek was. 15 years later, you fast forward, that was God's will. He was bringing me to my surrender through all those series of events. How do you separate the two? The way I look at it, if God is the ocean, and self-will might be the wave on top of the ocean, still part of the ocean. I simplify it that way. I do want to read one thing before I turn it over to Brandon in relation to the third step. And I got to tell this story real quick. So I'm working with a sponsee last week. He's 8 years sober. He hasn't done anything in quite some time. And he was slowly beginning to lose his mind. And he comes to me and asks me for help. And we're going through pages 60 to 62 in the big book, right? And he goes, I can't believe I just glanced over these pages for all these years. And I said to him, no big deal, man. It's just the root of your problem. No one had ever taken him and broken down page 60 to 62 because that is the root of our problem. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, and guess what? They punch back. And seemingly, we throw up our hands up and say, man, what the hell did we do? I didn't do anything. But invariably, that means every time I look back into the past, I'm going to find I made a decision based on me being consumed with me that has now put me in that position where I'm getting someone retaliating against me. That's karma. That's you reap what you sow. What goes around comes around. That's in our big book. You know, guys, what would happen if you cracked your book on page 1 and they said, hey, man, selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of your troubles. What would happen if that was on page 1? No, man, these guys are geniuses. They waited till page 63 or 62 to break it down for you. They had to talk about drugs and alcohol for a little while before they gave you the dose, the bad news. You know, I call it the shell game, right? Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps are the greatest shell game on earth, man. You come here thinking it's about drugs and alcohol being your problem, and you got a living problem. You come in here not looking for God, and that's all we got to offer. So, let me read this. So the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu spiritual book, is a great spiritual poem which has been called the Sermon on the Mount of Hinduism. The present value of the Bhagavad Gita is by no means confined to India and Indians. More and more Westerners are discovering that the Gita is an explicit and practical textbook on the technique of seeking God while working in the world. If you are sincerely pursuing truth, and if at the same time your duty places you in the midst of worldly obligations, you will find in the Gita a series of inspired instructions addressed directly to your problem. The central message is this. It's also in our 12 steps in the big book. Experience a surrender where your surrender includes your life is no longer your life. It's God's life. Put this God first. Then do your duty, whatever it is, but without any attachments to what it's going to produce. Work, but the results are the work of God. Work, but without the desire for a selfish reward. The third step in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is about that. That my life is no longer my business, but my conduct in my life is very important. So I must have self-examination. The third step also does something else. It says, God, take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. Bear witness. Brandon and I are bearing witness this weekend to the power of God in our lives. So our third step compels us to do this work with no desire for reward. I guess that's not a true statement to say we get nothing by coming here this weekend. Our spirits get fed. You know, you guys might be helping us more than we're helping you, but we expect no reward. There is no reward here. We are just being used, in our opinion, and somebody hears, like I said last night, we'll be contacted. So the third step. Don't get hung up on this idea of trying to figure out what God's will is and what self-will is. Your experience in 4 through 9, hopefully, will give you a new perspective on that. It'll be your perspective. But don't get stuck on the second and third step trying to figure anything out about God. There is nothing to figure out. Go ahead.
God, please speak through me. Allow me to transmit. The third step in a way that makes me sound really cool. That's fair. So page 42, just to recap, got to run back through this. So, Tarek and Brandon came to see us. They grinned, which we didn't like so much. And then they asked us if we thought we were alcoholic and addict and if we were really licked this time. We explored the first step and we conceded on some level on both propositions. Then Tarek and Brandon piled on us heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic or addict mentality, such as you exhibited before coming here, was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process, if we've done this correctly, snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that you could do the job yourself. Then they started outlining the spiritual program of action, which they and their sponsees had followed successfully. Although you maybe had some sort of concepts of God, our proposals to this point were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, which they're just now starting to outline, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant you would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That's not going to be easy. But they assured me that the moment that I made up my mind to go through the process, that you will have the curious feeling that your alcoholic or addict condition was relieved. And then they're going to go on and talk about how the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. So we're at this place in the third step where are you convinced? Are you convinced that everything that you've ever done didn't work? If you're not, well, then maybe you'll go try some more and maybe we'll see you next year, 2 years from now. Because it's that requirement to get to that place, right? We've got the ABCs on page 60. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Are you convinced that you're alcoholic or addict and that you can't manage your own life? Are you convinced that probably no human power could have relieved your alcoholism and drug addiction? And C, is it possible that there's a power out there that could and would solve that problem if you saw it? The original manuscript said if you're not convinced of A, B, and C at this point, reread the book all the way to this point or throw it away. Because if you still think you can do something, you're going to do something. If you're not convinced, then maybe you're willing to consider to do this other thing. So the third step, it's this decision, right? It's this decision of actually making a commitment to go forward. But there's so many things in this that this part of the book that it's new thinking, right? It's like, I've never looked at things this way, right? The first requirement is that Brandon be convinced that his life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I've got a lifetime of looking at it that way. Like, look at what I did. Failure at living, failure at dying. On that basis, I was almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives were good, right? I was living on self-propulsion. The 12 and 12 has a paragraph that really captures all of the way that I live very well. It says, but it is from our twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that most of us have suffered the most. We've been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that I fail to recognize is my total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. My egomania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either I insist upon dominating the people I know, or I depend on them far too much. If I lean too heavily on people, they will sooner or later fail me, for they are human too, and cannot possibly meet my incessant demands. In this way, my insecurity grows and festers. When I habitually try to manipulate others to my own willful desires, strangely, they revolt and resist me heavily. Then I develop hurt feelings, a sense of persecution, and a desire to retaliate. As I redouble my efforts at control and continue to fail, my suffering becomes acute and constant. I have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always I tried to struggle to the top of the heap, or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation in any one of those about me. True brotherhood, I had no comprehension. You see, because every situation I ever looked at, I was looking to see what I could get out of it. I'll do this for you, but what am I going to get? Right? I want everybody to pay me the maximum amount of effort or money for minimal effort, right? It was a couple years sober when a guy that listened to my fifth step pointed that one out to me. He said, so let me get this straight. you want everybody to just throw money at you, but you don't want to do anything. It was so weird the way he said it, because I was like, well, yeah, but is that wrong? You see, I had this existence where the show never came off well. I would think that you weren't treating me right, so I would try to show you how you were supposed to treat me. Then you wouldn't treat me that way, so I would try harder. Anybody in here ever try to convince somebody of something, and when they don't believe you, you convince them louder? So get this. On page 62, a guy recently was covering this page in a meeting. This was like a month ago. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt me, seemingly without provocation, but invariably, at some time in the past, they made a decision based on self, which later put me in a position to be hurt. And then the greatest statement of the hope in the big book is, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. I used to hear Tarek say that. That's the greatest statement of hope. And I was like, it's like, well, how is that the greatest statement of hope? Because if my troubles are of my own making, then all that has to happen is I have to change. If my troubles are of your making, then all of you have to change for me to be okay. And since I've been working really hard on changing myself, imagine how hard it's going to be for me to change you. But if I'm the basis of my troubles, then I can do something about it. So these troubles, they arise out of ourself. And the alcoholic and addict are extreme examples of self will run riot, though he doesn't usually think so. Above everything, alcoholics and addicts must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. Do the next right thing, right? But we could not live up to them, even if we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness, much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. So those two paragraphs, I'm only focused on myself 11 times. Kind of makes me start to wonder if I'm the problem. Because when I start to look at things from the perspective of I'm the problem, then I'm beat into a state of maybe realizing that I have to change in a deeper way. I have to experience this new frontier of unselfishness, right? Not me. And then at the bottom of page 62, it talks about these relationships, right? They're higher order, lower order, director, actor. Director is one who directs. Actor is one who performs the part. Then we have the principal and the agent, right? Principal is like the insurance company, State Farm or whoever it is. And then you have an agent. The agent is only allowed to act on behalf of the principal. They can't make special terms. They can't do deals that the principal doesn't agree to. And we have father and child, higher order, one who's the principal in the family that teaches and provides for, and the child, the ignorant one that has no idea how to live life, right? So we've got these higher order, lower orders, and what it makes me realize is that I'm not the higher order. I have to be a lower order. But I don't know about you guys, like, to be deputized as an agent of God. That sounds pretty fucking cool, right? I don't get a badge or anything, but I get to act on behalf of God. You see, Tarek and I are up here being agents for God. What this whole weekend is supposed to be is a pep rally for God. Is Tarek and I have been relieved of the bondage of self, and we're up here to testify. That's how this whole program started. Is people would testify to the power and the presence of God in their life. So if you think that it's not about God, well, it is. Now, it's just maybe not about the God that you think it is. It's some other God, but it's really the same one. So, and then they got these cool ninth step or third step promises. There's a lot of people like claim that AA has promises. They're actually the ninth step promises, but there's promises all through this book. My Sunday night meditation meeting, the thing that we do is we go through the third, the fifth, the ninth, the tenth, the 11th, and the 12th step promises, and we focus and meditate on a specific line out of each one, and we go in order. We start with the third, we go to the 12th, and we read the whole promise, and then we pick a specific line out of that, and somebody's supposed to share about that line and what their experience with that line is. And sometimes people actually do that. Other times they'll talk about some other stuff, and it's like, wait, I thought we were talking about the fact that we had a new employer. But they talk about, like, the fellowship being important. Anyway, I digress. But so it's a really cool meeting because it makes us dive in and really explore what does this line of this promise mean? And is there more to this promise, right? Because these are the third step promises. These happen as the result of the third step, okay? These are the things I get when I do this thing wholeheartedly. If I'm convinced of all those things, if I've met the requirements, if I've made the decision to go forward with the rest of the steps, and I do the affirmation, which is the prayer, then these are the promises that come to me. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, our employer provided what we needed if we kept him close and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. Our little plans and designs, I always hate that line because my plans are big. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. You see, because That part sounds really cool, like being reborn, right? Like, I get a new life. If I do this stuff, if I agree to the lower order of things, God being the higher order, me being the lower order, I get a new life. I hear people say sometimes, oh, I got my old life back. I don't want my old life. My old life was chaos. It was pain. It was suffering. It was depression. I don't want that. I want to do what the spiritual experience appendix talks about is I want to change. I want to become something different. My parents, they're good people. You meet them today, you meet them 10 years from now, they're probably going to be pretty much the same. And that's good, and that works for them. I'll tell you though, for Tarek and I mean, we've talked about it enough times, like, if next year I show up and I'm the same person that I am right now, that's failure to me. I want to be somebody new. I want to be a better version of me. And this is where this starts to happen, right? This is where my little plans and designs are thrown off to the side and somebody suggests let's meet at, you know, 5:45 and do a meditation meeting. Fine, let's see what happens, right? Am I going to trust that this power is in my life and it's going to make me useful and it's going to make that experience powerful for the people that attended and that they'll have an experience? I don't know if they will or not, but it'll be cool to watch. You see, because my new employer says, hey, do this and I'll provide all this other stuff for you. I'll take care of you. And so I watch. And then a couple years later, I see that some of those people have changed and they transformed and now they're sitting in the back of the room and they're coming here on their own accord and they want to be present. Like the work in the spiritual realm is paid off way out in the future. And all of us in here, I suspect, are like now people, right? The reason why I got drunk and high was I got to feel different right now. The spiritual realm is all about the future. It's all about you do this and you experience it later on. I pray and I meditate, and I can't tell the results during the day, but I'll tell you when I do notice the results is when I don't pray and meditate. My day's chaotic. The spiritual realm's kind of this paradoxical existence where nothing really seems to line up. Like one-to-one, but it's kind of like sometimes the removal of is the benefit to everything. So we get in this new realm where I'm willing to explore, right? I'm willing to see what life could be like, right? The short form of the third step says, made a decision to turn our will and life over the care of God as we understood God. Well, that seems pretty simple. But really, this is the place where you really just have to change everything. And then we've got this pitiful little prayer that I don't know why. See, it's my experience in my own life and watching other people that people's God shows up the way that they are, right? So I'm kind of a smartass, and I like to overthink things, and so God provides me smart-ass answers and gives me a bunch of information to really overthink, right? Because that's how I interact. And so my God's up there, and he's kind of snarky, right? And so it's like, so Bill's writing this third step prayer, right? And I can just visualize my God, whatever it is, like say that there is actually a heaven up there. God's sitting up there with St. Peter, and he's like, those alcoholics are writing a prayer to turn their will and their life over to me. And he looks at St. Peter and he's like, do they not know that I could take their life whenever I wanted? And St. Peter's like, just give them the prayer. So the prayer says, all right, so God, here, I'm going to give myself to you. You mean you created me and everything in it, and everything in the world, but I'll begrudgingly give you me, right? And then when I give myself to you, you can do whatever you want with me. And then the prayer kind of takes this little twist that like I start to realize, wait, this prayer isn't really about me. Relieve me of me, so that I can better do what you want. Take away all my struggles and difficulties and all this stuff so that other people will see that I've overcome these difficulties, and that will simply demonstrate to everybody else that you got all this power. And it's like, wait, so my difficulties don't go away for me? My difficulties go away for other people? This sounds like a bad deal, doesn't it? And then they put the disclaimer at the end. We thought well before taking the step, making sure that we were ready. Well, if you're going through the book by yourself, you just said the prayer. Now the disclaimer comes. You're like, shit, what did I just do? Because here's what I see, guys. Like this prayer, like I don't say this prayer except for when I'm doing step work, because for me, it's like a Pandora's box. It opens up my, like, what I'm saying is, hey, God, I want you to reveal all my struggles to me so I can see them so that it can, I can overcome them for other people, right? So what that's probably going to show me is that I'm going to have some struggles, right? Well, the struggles, the way that those show up is when I start writing inventory. And I start going back into these experiences, these horrific experiences where I was resentful and angry and thought that I was treated incorrectly. And I'm going to start reliving all of those experiences. And it's going to make me uncomfortable, right? It's by design, okay? Because it's when I start to get uncomfortable, I become willing to change. Anybody in here ever go to the gym? Yeah. Ever?
Yeah.
Only three people? That's it? Okay. So, when you go to the gym and you haven't been to the gym in a while, is it a pleasant experience? How do you feel the next day? How do you feel for the next 2 weeks? Right. So what happens when you go to the gym is you start lifting weights, and what happens is your muscles tear, right? And then as they're getting repaired, they're sore. But once they strengthen themselves, then you go back and you lift more and they tear again. And the more times you do this, the stronger you get. But it's actually the process of the tearing of the muscles that strengthens you. So the fourth step is this experience of I'm going to go in and get really uncomfortable so I can get stronger. And so what happens is when I say this prayer is it opens me up to, hey God, I'm headed to the gym. I want to be uncomfortable. Making a decision to go to the gym. And so people start the fourth step, and if they don't move forward in the fourth step, what ends up happening is they get really uncomfortable, they stay uncomfortable, and they usually go get drunk or high. Unless they finish the workout. Okay, the third step prayer occurs on page 63. You notice that there's no amen at the end of the prayer, right? There's an amen way over on page 76. It's the end of the seventh step prayer. So is it possible that everything you do from the third step to the seventh step is one continuous prayer? God, reveal me to be. Let me see who I really am. Take away all these difficulties. Let me see the way that I show up in all my relationships so that I no longer have to be that way. And please take me from where I am to where I could be to be useful to you. This is the beginning of that process. This is where it all starts. Step one was required for you to see that you need to do this. Step two is to explore the possibility that maybe you're insane and that there might be a power that could actually return you to that. This is where it starts. So, I'm not going to let you think well, because we're going to go to lunch, and I think you'll be safe and protected until we come back. Actually, why don't we do the prayer when we come back? But notice at the bottom of page 63, if you will, I was in a meeting one time, and I think it's the only meeting I've ever shared twice in, because I believe that if I have so much more to say that I should go to another meeting. This meeting was on the third step, and I had already shared, and there was a guy in the back of the room, and he said, so I've done my third step prayer, and I want to know when I should start my fourth step. And then it turned into a self-help meeting. And crosstalk was the name of the game, and people gave him all sorts of advice. Well, you start when you feel ready, and what your sponsor, you listen to your sponsor, and there was all this nonsense floating around the room, and I just couldn't help it. I just, like, when I'm supposed to share, there's like this laser beam that comes out of my chest. You may have seen the original, like, Alien, where it comes out. It's what it feels like for me when I'm supposed to share. I couldn't help it. I share it again. I'm like, okay, so on page 63, you got the prayer, and then at the bottom of the page, it's got very specific instructions of you say the prayer, and this is when you start your fourth step. The word is next. Say the prayer, next. Start your fourth step. Just like that. So, over lunch, let's think well. And then when we come back, we can say this pitiful prayer that God allowed Bill to write, even though he was certain that he could take our will in life whenever he wanted. Do you have anything else?
What time's lunch, Roscoe? 12. Okay, let's all come back at 1:15. Yeah. We'll move it up. We'll move everything up. 1:15. Now that spaces everything. I mean, that's a 2-hour break almost. It is a 2-hour break. I think that's plenty. You agree?
Yeah.